right, we got to talk about the hot button issue, the big debate.
The big debate, Biden versus Trump, the two great contenders in the ring, the grand quadrennial spectacle of American electoral politics, big debate.
I would like to see Biden versus Trump debate.
It's not going to fucking happen.
Run by Lix Friedman, where he's just like, you guys are friends, right? Let's all chat and have a nice time and...
So you're looking at me like I know who Lex Friedman is, or like I watched the Destiny Finkelstein debate.
No one knows who he is. We just have to tolerate him. Okay, right? Yeah.
He's like impartial, like all sides type of guy. He set up like a round table with two people on the Gaza side, two people on the pro genocide side, and they like hashed it out, right?
Right. He's like an intellectual dark web guy who I think has the plausible deniability of being apolitical or neutral. And he does get a broader range of guests than like Joe Rogan does these days. Sure. And to his credit, you know, he said who should debate on Israel-Palestine, and he did choose Finkelstein and his preferred companion, Moin Rabini,
okay,
who is a Dutch Palestinian scholar, and they did.
And it was Benny Morris and Stephen
right versus Benny Morris, who's a legit historian that Finkelstein and Rabini both respect, even though he, you know, he started off as more of a, I don't know if he's a critic, but like a legitimate historian of Israel, and is now a Zionist propagandist, and then just this idiot, awful, evil YouTuber named Destiny who. Became sort of the butt of everybody in the debate.
I'm surprised that that Destiny fella sat down with those guys and did it, because all I saw online was him trying to squirm his way out of the debate for like weeks and weeks and weeks. I guess they finally put him on the spot.
I'm not surprised that he did it, because he is he's like perfect for like the right wing type figure, because he is a Biden supporter.
Very right.
He is a self-identified neoliberal. He's a big defender of U.S. centrism,
Cuban American,
and he does it. I don't know much about his background besides that he's like a video game nerd, but he does it in a way that sounds smart to people who don't think too hard about what he's saying, because he just barrages you with facts and has like a very confident way of saying this stuff.
And has read a lot of Wikipedia articles. And then, all I saw in the, I saw like the hot takes from the debate, and it was basically the dude Destiny like, if you look on Wikipedia, there's a section 4 of the chapter thing. And then Norman Finkelstein being like, you absolute moron, Mr. Cavatelli, you are a disgrace. You are a sick dog. I should put you down. You disgust me, you absolute idiot.
Mr. Botticelli. I'll give Lex Friedman credit for letting Finkelstein go off like that, because that's obviously very fun.
Yeah.
But I think when it comes down to it, the debate, I think we're here with Ignacio Choi.
Yeah, hi. Welcome to the show.
If not now.
Thank you.
And I think it's a pretty good way of thinking about the pro-Palestine movement, because it's won the debate, essentially. Because like in that debate, it's a question of, you know, Finkelstein and Rabini, they both appear to be very good progressive liberals to me, progressive in some respects, of course. And they're basically arguing like, look, there's international law and there's a history of negotiations between Israel and Palestine. And this is what the Palestinian side has done to try to make progress. And at every step, Israel has, Rabini kept talking about this hamster wheel where they say like, well, if you acknowledge Israel, for example, then we can go on to the next stage. But there is no next stage. They're just stuck in the wheel. And that's by design. And essentially, Benny Morris's side was like, look, international law doesn't matter. It's all fake. And Rabini responds like, okay, well, if international law doesn't matter, that's how you get October 7th. And like, if it doesn't matter to Israel, if you separate civilians and military targets, then why should it matter to Hamas? Like, why are we talking about Hamas as being these barbarians when... You know, Israel is the same thing. Like, we need to have some standards to have this debate. And they didn't have an answer for that. And Israel doesn't. All they can do is either deny it, and denying it just doesn't work anymore. So I don't know. Do you ever, like, do you feel like there's still a debate to be had, Ignacio? Or I feel like we're long past that point.
I think so. I mean, debates happen all the time, obviously, among ourselves, but also with anyone who comes to a protest and, you know, is angry about it or just passes by, wants to talk. So there's a lot of debate going on. But the fundamental idea is people are getting killed. Lots of people, millions of people are in mortal danger. And there's no justification for that. And once you basically have that basic standard for people, you know, you don't write the Palestinians off as some, you know, a non-group. There's no more debate, really. Yeah. And that's really the debate that you have. Are they people like all other people? And of course they are.
But I don't hear anyone on the Israeli side having a good faith debate along those lines. They just say everything bad that you hear about Gaza is a lie and that Israel has a right to go to war, which, you know, from an international law perspective, I guess they do. But then in the course of the war, they're committing tremendous war crimes. And there's no defense for that. There's just denial. Like in the debate, Destiny and Morris just say that all the numbers you're hearing are fake because they're from Hamas, and that the people starving are just... At one point, B'nai Morris actually says, like, how many people are starving? Like 2 to 6 a day? Well, probably the same amount starve in Israel, 2 to 6 a day, which is ridiculous. And so, like, it's a 5-hour debate, and at the end of it, you just get one... It's just law of the jungle at the end. It's might makes right. And that's the reality of the situation. I don't know what kind of debate you can have at that point.
I think maybe Benny Morris is right about the numbers of dead not being correct, but I'm pretty sure it's in the other direction because it seems as though bombing the hospital and destroying all the health infrastructure and basically like culling the ability of the media and just whatever authorities are left on the ground to even count the dead or to show the massacre that was happening was part of the first couple months plan of the invasion and attack on the people. So if the numbers are wrong, they're wrong in a much worse way.
Yeah, I mean, the death count on the Palestinian side has sort of frozen for the last few months, right? I'm still hearing 30,000, which, 30,000 is big enough that we should have a ceasefire. There should be international condemnation, but... Well, I mean, what do you think the numbers are? It's probably upwards of 100,000 at this point.
I mean, if you kill the people who are counting, if you destroy all the hospitals, then there's no more to count. And so that's really what's happening now. But, I mean, if you look at the Israeli side, if you look at the spokespeople, if you look at the, you know, the government, the press, it's clearly very strategic communication. And it's clearly managed not on putting down sort of lasting truth. It's just managing the news cycle. So they bomb a hospital... And they immediately put out something that, oh, Hamas did it. They shot themselves. It was like a Hamas rocket and so on. And it doesn't matter whether that stands up to fact. It doesn't. It's just for disrupting the news cycle and for sort of managing the initial shock. And after that first hospital and that ridiculous debate about where the rocket came from, they have bombed every other hospital in the Gaza Strip exactly the same way. But they already blunted sort of the impact of destroying hospitals, which are targets that are, you know, they should never be attacked. And it's war crime. And there are all these quotes from like Biden and, you know, the different governments when it happened in Ukraine. They say, oh, if you attack a hospital, that's a war crime. You should be in The Hague, you know. So Israel is very conscious of that. And is like all the communications are sort of geared towards warding it off. Same with the bombing the aid convoys. You know, they say, oh, there was a stampede. Oh, Hamas fired on their own people. You know, it's always that line from Jack Nicholson in The Shining. It's like, I believe he did it to himself. You know, it's clearly the cynical strategic communication, but it's really just about getting it out of the news and, you know, getting sort of public opinion to not rebel.
It's been a masterful job, I have to say, by the Israelis and by their... I hate to say surrogates in the U.S. mainstream media, in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, in the White House, because as you described, there's this constant news cycle. These atrocities will happen, and then they say, well, we're investigating. And, of course, the investigation maybe comes out, maybe it doesn't, months later. But as you said, it's been finessed and finagled. The U.S. press, I think, has been incredibly, incredibly in the bag, obviously, the entire time. And I think a lot of the disconnect that younger people have who aren't reading the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal are reading other sources is this, like, refusal on the part of the press to look deeper than that hamster wheel, look deeper than the surface, look deeper than the news cycle, look deeper than this war started on October 7th. It's been masterfully done.
I mean, so I've been a subscriber to New York Times since I came to the U.S. almost 20 years ago, and I just canceled it recently because, the gap has never been greater. The gap between reality and what they write has never been greater. About Gaza and about other things too. You know, there was a headline that the Times put out about Boeing, and they said, Boeing is trying to balance profitability with safety. What kind of headline is that? You know, that's insane. That's insane. So, and if you sort of look closer and you don't like read the Times for, you know, to improve your digestion or something, it's just ridiculous. So they lap it up. You know, they don't have to be convinced by the Israeli governments to have their news cycle managed. They're on board with that. And everybody, the whole young generation, everybody who stopped having a TV 5 years ago, you know, who never watches TV again, who's not on cable, they all stopped reading all these like old print newspapers. You know, it's that's a fundamental thing that's super accelerated in the last 5 months, but also in the last couple of years.
Well, I think another part of the dynamic, which is true for the Times and the Democratic Party, is there's a coalition of the base, of people who read it, of people who vote for the Democrats, and that includes Zionists who will, you know, are just so emotionally committed to that project, either just from their youth, you know, growing up Jewish in the United States, or what have you, just believing that Israel is a moral country, is a just country, and that they're surrounded by people who want to murder them and commit another Holocaust. And those people are just, you know, they're, if you're going to treat this fairly, you would treat Israel the way that they treat Putin, for example. And the Times can't do that. Biden can't do that. You're starting to see the Democratic Party shift a little bit, and you're even starting to, you know, I think the New York Times has covered atrocities at time, and CNN too. You know, sometimes these stories do get out that Israel is blatantly lying and covering up atrocities, but they're just not the focus of the coverage.
You can see the difference in, say, watching live footage of the press conferences that the State Department does. What's that asshole's name, that absolute ghoul, John Kirby? Kirby, right? He's out there day in and day out. And the press, especially the international press, are asking tough questions and they don't have very good answers to it. But between that right there, the pressing of government officials on these atrocities, on the policies in place, and the actual production of news at the end, a lot happens, right? That's where we see this coalition that you're talking about, Andy, and we see this massaging in PR. Because, of course, as we know, media ownership is like, you know, four or five companies, and it's an extremely monopolized industry right now, very tied to both of the political parties in this country.
Yeah, it's very strange. And, of course, we all know there's this, you know, Noam Chomsky manufactured consent, and it never looked more real than now. And I never really quite liked that because I also thought it was simplistic. It certainly isn't the case that, you know, the owners pick up the phone, tell the reporters what to write and so on. So I always thought, oh, there's more going on. It's a more complicated mechanism. It's more mediated somehow. And whatever, however that is, you know, it's the outcome. And all these people who work there for the New York Times and for Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, they all went to top, you know, universities, and they went to journalism school. So they know all this. So they know that if you have, I don't know, three times the coverage for Israel than for Gaza, or 10 times the coverage, you know, mentioning, they know that all that matters. So nothing is accidental there. No, they know what they're doing. There's no oversight there. So on the one hand, they know what they're doing. On the other hand, they're sort of self-regulating, you know. They don't need to be told what to do. They sort of have it in their mind that this is the right thing. And they're in their own bubble. So it's very strange. Like when people go to protest in the New York Times, like they tell, you know, there's been a lot of protests to say, tell the truth, stop telling lies. I want to go and tell these reporters, you know, be a real reporter, talk to protesters, talk to everyone. You know, and for some reason that's not happening. And I guess that's a lost cause.
Well, I guess in Gaza itself, it sounds like all of the reporters are just embedded with the IDF. So they can't get too far outside of their leash. Al Jazeera is like one news outlet that's has not been embedded in the IDF, and they were just all arrested yesterday trying to cover the raid on the Al-Shifa hospital. It's a combination of Israel doing a very good job of, you know, murdering Palestinian journalists and like preventing real coverage. And then besides that, just, you know, embedding journalists who they think are going to make their case as strong as possible.
I always try to, you know, I try to be empathetic and I try to place myself as much as possible in the minds of other people, even the most horrific people, right? Even like the Benjamin Netanyahu's or the Putins or Zelensky's or Biden's of the world. And if I were to steel man, you know, where the New York Times ideology behind this is, or their idea of justice is, it's that Ukraine is a democracy and Israel is a democracy. And Putin runs an authoritarian dictatorship and Hamas runs an authoritarian dictatorship. So those are the sides that our people of our republic should be on, right? That, I guess, works adequately, again, if your coverage of this event started on October 7th. The question is, why do the Palestinians not have a state? Like, why is it that in Gaza and in the West Bank for the last decades, there's been no potential for people to democratically express the kind of state and government they want? That's an October 6th story, right? And so even under the guise of like democracy promotion or, you know, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. They have a strong freedom of the press. They have competing parties. They're a liberal democratic capitalist nation. Even that falls on their face because they are the ones, of course, who are stopping the Palestinians and have been for decades stopping the Palestinians from expressing those very same rights.
I mean, they have effective control over the population in the West Bank and in Gaza, right? They're surrounding them on all sides. They're telling them where they can go. They can't intervene any time. They provide all the necessary things, you know, water, gas, or used to. And now they're basically killing them and expelling them. So in that sense, they're excluding a really large part of the population from whatever political process. And in that sense, it's very clearly an apartheid regime. So it's a democracy in the way that South Africa during apartheid was a democracy, right? So that's not a democracy. But so the other thing is about people, so putting yourselves in other people's minds. So Schumer, Chuck Schumer, senator, gave this speech, you know, criticized Netanyahu, but then again said what he said before that, so Israel and, you know, the idea of having a Jewish state there is in his bones. He will always be on the side. And I get it that that was a generational experience for people growing up after the war. You know, it was really a thing. They were really invested. And, you know, as the people I've been protesting with, and if not now, Jewish Voice of Peace, tell me, if you grew up, you know, Jewish in the United States, there's a whole ecosystem for raising you and integrating you, you know, and making it part of your life. You know, you go to summer camp, you go to Israel, you talk about it a lot, and it's a thing for you. So for the young people to grow out of that, you know, and to be able to get some distance from that and say, it's not just that we are told that Israel's on our side, it's also we are able to see what else is going on, what they're doing there, what's being done in our name. That is a really big step. And the young people are doing it, and someone like Chuck Schumer is not willing to do it. You know, he's not willing to take that step. And he's staying invested. And for a lot of people now, people who grew up Zionists, you know, people who grew up sort of with this idea that, you know, they have Israel as their thing and so on. Many people are starting to ask themselves this question now. You know?
I think a big divide maybe from, you're talking about generational differences, is Chuck Schumer is old enough to remember, Joe Biden's old enough to remember, like, leftish sort of progressive labor Zionist governments having existed in Israel. You know, having governed in Israel for the first many decades of it being in existence. And so they understand Israeli democracy as like an open process, and they see, sure, there's like outright like Kahanist fascists in government right now, but we remember when it was Golda Meir and, you know, she was a good socialist or whatever. But what that elides, of course, is that it seems to me, and I think to all of us, right, that Benjamin Netanyahu and his government of Zionist fascists, right, or like theological fucking authoritarians, genocide heirs, I suppose you could call them, right? That is the inexorable logic of an apartheid regime. We understand that, right? That the Netanyahu government isn't a fluke. It isn't a mistake that the Israeli voters made. It isn't something that can just be rolled back if you stop the judicial reforms and have true democracy, or if America supports civil society in positive ways in Israel. It is an inexorable logic of an apartheid state that seeks to subjugate millions upon millions of people. And I think young people, people my age even, right, not even that young, have never known anything but the results of this inexorable logic of the apartheid regime. So I think the farthest that Chuck Schumer can go, and maybe the farthest even that Biden can go, being of their Zionist generation, is to say that Netanyahu needs to hold elections, right? That's as much as you're going to get.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, let's not get Chuck Schumer too easily off the hook, right? He's one of the most powerful politicians in the world, and he surely knows a little bit more than like a kid going to summer camp. So he can't play that card, you know? And if you just read, you know, if you read a little bit about the history of Israel and about the history of labor Zionism, about if you read like Moshe Dayan, you know, you see that Israel from day one was built on massacres. So this beautiful story of a people building their own homeland, you know, as a refuge, there's lots of massacres built into that, you know, and by people like Dayan, other people very, very openly and deliberately, and they talk about it. So once you sort of go that step further and stop believing your own myths, you know, you should know what you're doing. And I'm sure someone like Chuck Schumer is sort of capable and, you know, knows all of that at some point. So what's shocking to me is that he and many other people find it so easily for themselves to justify that to killing a large number of people. They say, oh, these many people died, this is somehow justified by something. You know, by, oh, they're not a democracy. Oh, Hamas are terrorists. Oh, they started it, whatever. You know, it's very like, look out for that. When people start saying killing a large number of people is somewhat justified, has to be explained away, that's really very dangerous. And I want to say that it cuts many different ways. You know, everybody needs to be aware of that. You know, don't say, oh, they all need to die. And yeah.
So just talking a little bit about, if not now, moving towards your activism, like what do you, If Not Now has been around for a long time. I've seen their actions for years. What is the organization? How did it start? And what sort of phase is it in now?
Yeah, I can't I don't know the whole history so much. I haven't been with them very long. I really only started after October 7. I went to I think one action in 2017 when Trump put in the Muslim ban. There were a lot of demonstrations. There were some at JFK. And then someone invited me to a demonstration that was organized by If Not Now. And that's how I knew them. And that was back then. And then I didn't really do anything with them until October 8. And I'm also not Jewish. But I thought it was important for me to sort of support them, you know, and have really the highest respect for them. So they're a little bit. There's a whole number of different organizations, and they sort of talk to different audiences, and they have somewhat different positions. And If Not Now is quite open, so doesn't talk about Zionism maybe in the way some other organizations talk about. So one of the ideas of If Not Now is that if people come from any sort of point of view, but say we don't want to sort of support what's going on there, we have doubts or difficulties, we want to talk to them. So we don't want to, so there's no barrier to entry that they say, Israel needs to disappear, or Israel is a Zionist state, that and so on. Because a lot of people aren't there, right? But a lot of people say, they are confused at what's going on. They say, this is happening in our name. How can we understand that? So that's a little bit different from maybe of some of the other organizations. And so in that context, right now, as the protest movement against the genocide and for Palestinian liberation has grown so much, there is a lot of thought about where we need to direct our energy and what the greatest contribution is that we can do. And one of the things that we talked about is looking at what props up sort of the things that make this genocide possible, right? It's the Israeli military machine, it's U.S. diplomatic support, and it's lobbying inside the United States. So it's organizations like IPAC, for example, that have systematically lobbied U.S. politicians in both parties, telling them you need to support Israel and you need to support the current Netanyahu government and whatever they do militarily, or you're anti-Semitic, or you are, you know, against the Jews and so on. So, and this is quite an extremist position. And to just expose that, to say this is what IPAC is doing, like the American Public Affairs Committee for Israel, this is what they're doing. They're not just some sort of benign interest organization. You know, they have a very clear, quite extremist agenda. I think that's a thing that we're trying to do. So to give an example, it's like you talk about the NRA. If you could make it so odious for politicians, at least Democratic politicians, to not take money from the NRA, you know, that's sort of attacking lobbying. And you say, if you take money from the NRA, then you're part of the problem. So if you take money from IPAC, then you're part of the problem. You know, you're part of this infrastructure that sustains the genocide that's going on right now.
And so, what would you say distinguishes, if not now, from a group like JVP?
Part of it is just sort of historical. I mean, JVP is a lot bigger, I don't really know which organization has been around longer and the long back history of them. Yeah, I wish I could say more about that.
Yeah, I'm not really sure either. Other than if not now, seems to have a more of a like you were talking about, like a JVP seems to be more of like a vector for activists that are specifically around this issue. Whereas if not now, I don't know. It seems to be a little bit more. You know, the actions I've seen are like we're Jews and we're deeply disturbed about what's going on in Israel and we want to take action to stop it. Whereas JVP, I don't know, they seem like historically that they've been more specifically like against Zionism as a politics, but I'm not really sure if that distinction matters anymore.
So I think all the organizations and everybody who's an activist in protesting is trying to do something with all the rage and grief and confusion and all the feelings of, you know, powerlessness and all the feelings to do something and channel them and articulate them. And that's the task of organization. Right, so if you protest, it's not really rage that makes you protest. It's something else. It's rage put into determination, or despair changed into determination. And how you do that is you organize, you know, and you organize by getting together, but also like shaping certain actions. And for If Not Now, and for JVP also, having aspects of Jewish identity in there, including religious identity, including rabbis, including mourning ceremonies, is one way of doing that, of protesting as Jews and expressing that as Jews. And that's also sort of politically important because of this idea that a lot of this genocide is committed in the name of a Jewish identity, and to reclaim that and say, no, this is not about Judaism. This is certainly not speaking in our name or in anyone's name.
Yeah, I read the ADL guide to the different groups that are behind pro-Palestinian protests, and the part about If Not Now is pretty incredible because they don't really have anything to say about them except like one group had a flyer with a paraglider on it that implies they support Hamas. And then besides that, they just say like some things If Not Now has said has been divisive within the Jewish community, which is just like, well, they're just saying politics that are not popular with all Jews. Obviously, any political group would say that. But they condemn If Not Now for that reason.
It's funny. I guess we should be a little tougher than they criticize us more. Because if they have nothing bad about us to say, that's really a bad sign.
You got to get more anti-Semitic.
So If Not Now had an action at the ADL conference last week. It's more than a week ago already. And so it was a 7-hour Shiva in front of the Javits Center. And it was expressing our disagreement with what the ADL is doing, not only giving an award to Jared Kushner for whatever reason, but also basically weaponizing anti-Semitism as something to be used to justify the genocide in Gaza. And so people who were there were against it, spoke out against it, and spoke out against it throughout the whole 7 hours from a position of Jewish ethics and Jewish identity. And if the ADL finds that's okay, well, we're happy, but I don't think they are. Yeah.
So I've also heard some people who do want to come into these protests and make them more riotous or disruptive or aggressive in certain ways. And they've been upset about various, you know, managerial or peacekeeping entities that want to control optics, that want to make the action safe in some way or nonviolent. And if not now, I've heard as like one target of that. Have you noticed any of that
Yes. So protest? Let me talk about that. So first of all, different actions have different audiences and different things they're trying to do. But I think most people in the protest movement, I can't speak for everyone, but basically I think we agree we do strategic nonviolence. Yeah? We're not talking about whether violence against a genocidal attack, a campaign is justified. It certainly would be under certain circumstances. But in the United States, nonviolence is strategic because there's no point, you know, picking fights just for a show or just for action. So what we want to do something else. We want to, first of all, make a statement in the public space, you know, that we're not. And we want to disrupt and impede and shut down sort of things that make U.S. support for the genocide possible. So in some sense, this is actually a fight about public opinion in the United States. But it is also sort of, civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience, shutting it down, you know, by refusing to take part, you know, collectively in sort of this thing. And a lot of that is influenced by the Vietnam War. So there was some debate about, you know, peace policing where we tell protesters what to do. We never do that. We never tell people who come to our actions what to do, you know. But we first of all, we try to organize to keep people safe from being run over by cars or from getting into, confrontations with provocateurs. And there are some. There are counter-protesters who try to provoke people. So we're trying to, mitigate that. Basically have an idea what we're trying to accomplish and make that statement in the best way possible.
So increasingly now in the 5 months since this war began, you've seen, I think, maybe a success of the protests, which is that giant cracks have now opened up in the Democratic Party coalition, right? Between youth and older voters, between pro-Palestinian, especially Arab-American Democratic voters in places like Michigan and like the hardcore of the Zionist movement within the Democratic Party. So is there a sense that you're having some successes at this point, that you're able to express and protest enough that it's starting to make this your position unavoidable, and that's causing the sort of political contestation necessary in order to perhaps stop this genocide?
So I think the position is already unavoidable. I think the movement succeeded of putting this idea in the public space that the genocide needs to stop. There needs to be immediate measures, ceasefire, end of the siege, but also long-term measures, you know, Palestinian liberation and to apartheid. But obviously, not only have we not stopped the campaign in Gaza, it's getting worse by the day. The situation is really it's not even stagnating, it's getting worse. You know, people are starving, people are living in even worse, ever worse conditions, And the big attack on Rafah is, you know, likely to start any day. So it's a terrible situation. And so we are also, I think I myself experienced this, you know, we go on and on for months and months. And there are some, you know, changes. There are some statements that change, positions that change. But you always feel, so now there should be an end to it. It should change. You know, there should be a breakthrough. But there isn't. It goes on and on and on. And so we have to remind ourselves, we have to stay in the fight, you know, do what we need to do to stay in the fight. Take a breath, you know, reconsider, plan, strategize, renew. And then the key is to just really stay in and remind the politicians, remind the public, remind everybody every day in every place. So it's not just one big action, it's many, many actions everywhere all the time.
But that is the basic point, right, is to drive a giant wedge within the Democratic Party coalition, because the Republican Party, it seems to me, is all on board with Israel. Maybe there's some dissident rightists who aren't, but I think by and large they are, most of the Republicans. So, like, is this your strategy? Is this something that you talk about? How do we get, like, how do we continue to drive this wedge deeper and deeper? Do you think it's going to eventually be so embarrassing for the Biden administration that they're going to have to back off?
I would sort of like look at it from the other way. Maybe it's one thing that people are thinking about, but it's really an objective fact. It's not that people say, oh, you know, how could we split the Democratic Party? It's like people go at it the other way. People say, we've reached a point where I cannot vote for someone, even if it's a symbolic vote. I cannot vote for someone who killed my whole family. So Palestinian activists say that. You know, people who live in New Jersey or Chicago or Dallas say, my whole family is dead. No, the man who's in charge in the United States made that possible. I cannot vote for that man. That, to me, is as clear as a human social political fact as it gets. And that's not even strategy. That's just how it is. And a lot of people feel like that. And you could say at some point it's a dilemma, because certainly Trump's not going to be any better than Biden at this. So, and I have no idea how that's going to work in the long term. And one could say, maybe this is the moment when the political system, the two parties, this duopoly, you know, where they had the primaries, where nobody really needed to pay attention because nothing was decided. When that's really in a crisis moment, that's not so easily managed, when it basically breaks down. But honestly, I have no idea what's going to happen. But all the blank votes, all that is based on fact. Yeah.
So why I brought up that debate early on to start off is because I do think it's an interesting dynamic that when we're trying to defend people in Gaza and Palestine generally, we're referring to international law and we're referring to, you know, the proper way to carry out a war and just a concept of, you know, like a rules-based order. Like Israel is, you know, at The Hague now being tried for genocide. And so shouldn't this be a sign to turn things back? And obviously it's not. There is a, you know, a alleged red line now around Rafah, and maybe that slowed Israel's invasion of Rafah. They've certainly carried out operations and continued to do bombing and continued to starve Rafah, but they haven't done the invasion yet, as far as I know. And if they do, what will be Biden's response? What will that red line translate to? Probably nothing. But I think it's obviously a result of the polling and the protests that they've had to at least pay some lip service to create some kind of red line here. On the other hand, these protests have delegitimized the Democratic Party, which they should, because the Democratic Party is not legitimate. Chuck Schumer was pretty wholeheartedly supportive of Trump's handling of Israel, including moving the embassy to Jerusalem and the sham peace process that Kushner was pushing that went along with that. Like, there's really no division there, except the Republican Party is a little bit more nakedly racist. They're both basically exactly as racist. They think that Jewish Israeli lives are worth more than Arab and Palestinian lives. So I guess the sort of dilemma there is like, is this movement just being forced into a position of saying, we're Democratic voters who you're alienating, and if you want to win us back, you have to make stronger red lines, have to be stronger on Israel, have to show us that you will be better than Trump, which, again, I mean, this is like a, you know, we got to do what we got to do to stop a genocide, of course. I'm not criticizing anyone for taking that strategy. But I think, you know, you're a leftist, right? We met in a Marxist reading group. Is there a way out of that framework?
First of all, let me say, I don't think there's a unified strategy when it comes to voting. But I think a lot of people have made up their mind that it's impossible for them to vote for Biden. Some other people have not made up their mind and are in that dilemma and don't see how that's going to play out. So I think these debates are being, people have these debates right now and they're coalescing around it. And you could guess that it's not going to end well for Biden. So, but let's just put it on the record that in terms of red lines and what the U.S. and what Biden could do, Biden could end this whole situation with three phone calls. He'd have to pick up the phone and call his U.N. ambassador to the United States, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Lynn Thomas Greenfield, and tell her to put out a resolution for an immediate permanent ceasefire at the U.N., and not veto it, but sponsor it. The second one is he would have to call the Pentagon or whoever ships the weapons to not ship the munitions, you know? So it's not even about the money at this point. It's about the material supply of bombs, because Israel does not have the stocks to just keep up bombing, you know, without U.S. resupply. So that's the fun thing. And the third thing, he should call the U.S. ambassador in Egypt to get in an A truck and just drive through the border, you know, and challenge the Israelis to stop him. You know, so they wouldn't necessarily dare stop a convoy with the U.S. ambassador. Certainly, they wouldn't bump it if they're smart. So he could. Bottom line is, he could make this end in three phone calls if he wanted. So all this pussyfooting about airdrops, the harbor that's going to take months, you know, the red lines. This is all window dressing. This is all trying to put up a show, and with this idea that there is a bargain to be had with his electorate, and a large part of the electorate, I think, has already decided the youth vote. You know, there's no bargain there. No, unless he makes that three phone calls, which he's not going to make, no one's ever going to vote for him again. Yeah.
But my question is, like, how do we, you know, what other directions could this movement take besides trying to make the Democrats better, trying to make the New York Times better?
I don't think it's about making the New York Times better either at this point.
These protests have been like, you know, we see how you're covering it and it's wrong.
I do want to say it no longer feels like some liberal moment in the 70s, you know, Robert Redford at the end of The Fly of the Condor, where the last line is, will they print it? You know, sort of the pious belief, if only the media would print it. Yeah. We're no longer at that moment. I think a lot of people say these institutions like the New York Times, they're total write-offs, you know, and they're big institutions and they shouldn't be write-offs, but that's a sideshow. So I think right now nobody really has like a laid out plan for the future. Some people think they do, maybe. I don't think they have a plan. But I think one other thing is, if you look what the movement's actually doing, what people are actually organizing, right? It occurred to me yesterday that it's no longer based in the universities and it's no longer mainly students. So we had other times when the main sort of focus, the main like center of protesting was in the university. It's no longer the case, you know?
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Yeah, it's everywhere. So it's really the multitude in that sense by Hartin Negri. But that includes a lot of immigrants, a lot of working people, but it also includes a lot of professionals, people who are sort of have skills in managing things. From doctors to school teachers to people who work in NGOs, to people who know how to organize events You know, you go into some of the Zoom calls, it feels like you're in a business meeting. You know, you're planning a project. It's project management. You know, you have a spreadsheet and everything. So these are civic society skills. These are skills that you can really use to actually plan stuff. You know, this is a little different from having a student group who can basically just talk.
Yeah, and like, you know, when I say that, it's everywhere. You know, in New York now, I'm not sure how it is other places. I guess I was just in Miami. I didn't see any keffiyehs around. But in New York, you see keffiyehs everywhere. You see the Palestinian flag pins. And even in the Upper West Side the other day, I saw like a totally normal Upper West Side woman walking around with Palestine earrings, which is, you know, that's like a real, I would think of that neighborhood as like a real, like firmly Zionist neighborhood. And it's very like publicly popular. And you know, in the punk scene in New York, like every punk show now is now a pro-Palestine benefit with like a table of information about the conflict and various groups involved in the Palestinian resistance. And it does remind me of this distant memory of the Second Intifada period where you saw keffiyehs everywhere and people made fun of it then, but I'm sure people make fun of it now, of course, but it's sort of returned to this cultural moment where like solidarity with Palestine, with Palestinian people means something to people. And it means something in terms of like how people are living their lives, what they're interested in, what movies they're seeing, what books they're reading, what food they're eating. But again, I don't see, it's hard for me to see like how, like what's that, what is that moving towards? And, you know, obviously, like, you know, the way I'm trying to think about this is there's only so much we can change here in the United States, like in terms of like what happens in the Israel-Palestine conflict. We have to translate that into changing things in the United States to like not just get rid of AIPAC and like New York Times or the Democrats or whatever, but just change the way politics and life is in the United States where, you know, the state will not have the power that it does. Obviously, that's a huge, unimaginable project. And like making a red line about Rafah is more, seems like an easier goal. But I think what's so scary about this moment is nothing really seems possible.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about what it looks like longer term after the Biden-Trump election, where, you know, the dust is going to settle, who votes for who, what this does to the Democratic Party, what it does to the Republican Party. If we zoom out a little bit on this and take it in its context, we have to place it alongside the Ukrainian-Russian war as well. And what we're seeing in the Middle East, as what we're seeing in Eastern Europe right now, is like the visceral, very real incapacity of the U.S. ruling class and the United States and its material capacities, its diplomatic capacities, to exert its will upon other nations, even in ways that it did 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's one of the privileges that we have here, right? That it is our particular ruling class, large fractions of our ruling class, that have a real effect on what happens on the ground in Israel and Palestine. If we look in 5, 10, 15 years or so, you're already seeing in Ukraine passing the buck on to the European Union and European powers to deal with that conflict. And you're starting to see things change in the Middle East. It seems as though the United States is assertively pulling back in the region. It appears as though some sort of Iranian-Saudi detente is bound to happen, maybe with the help of China, in order to stabilize the Middle East without the United States any longer. I wonder what we'll think in 10, 15 years or so about the power that we have right now to affect this event. Versus the power we might have when the United States no longer has the hegemonic power that it has now. What happens in a conflict like that when there isn't even like a token red line that a Joe Biden could put on?
I want to add to that too, that it's pretty likely Netanyahu would like, after he finishes off Hamas, you know, quote unquote, in the Gaza Strip, to go after Hezbollah, which would be the spark of a much larger confrontation in the region. And yeah, this public pressure might put limits on that as well. So there's like tremendous value to these protests and to this expression of public power. And again, this is not something we'll really be able to understand for maybe 10 years.
One more thing is I think that when we talk about capacity, we talk about the immediate short-term goal of stopping these atrocities, stopping the ethnic cleansing, stopping the killing and the murder. I mean, this is clear that what you're doing is extremely important work, what everybody's doing out there to try to put pressure on the state to do that. When we look at, say, like the Middle East, we understand that U.S. power is essential there, right? But like one of the things we need to set up long term is that the working classes of the United States and the working classes of Gaza and the working classes of Iran, Ukraine, Russia, China, and everywhere have an ability to still impose pressure on ruling classes even when American unipolar hegemony is gone, which is to say, like, the tactics that we take now, when they can have an effect on our ruling class, helping out the ruling class of Israel, it's going to have to be different in 10, 15, 20 years or so. There's going to have to be direct interrelationship between different working classes organized in some sort of internationalist capacity to even do the things that we're doing now. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to sort of get into the geopolitical, you know, game of speculating about these things, because it's a big chessboard and a lot of what is said like turns out to be different. So I don't think the US is going to give up the Middle East at any time. You know, they call it the Middle East, you know, West Asia, that little outpost there. But they, and I do think they actually have, you know, the power to decide what Israel does, despite the hand wringing and despite the, you know, the pretending not to. So the question is, can we figure out a way that that's going to work where everybody's alive, you know, at the end? So talking about international solidarity, I think so the normal state of the working class internationally and nationally, the normal state of the working class, as long as there is capitalism, is to be divided in different, you know, sections, being played off each other, and also divided internationally. And imperialism loves to play that game, you know, loves to say, you got to be with your country, you got to fight these other people, and they do it. You know, that's been history for a long, long time. And to step up to say, for people in the United States, the democratic multitude, you know, to say, we want to find a solution where the U.S. plays a role where all the other multitudes, the working classes of this country, can live and survive, you know, and is essential. And it's essential for all the countries there.
Well, this seems like a very good place to leave off on the main episode and go behind the paywall where we're going to be talking about, because you're of German background, Ignacio, we're going to be talking about all the various mental catapults and wailing and caterwailing that the German left and Germans in general have.
And some American Trotskyists, too. I was unaware that the SWP is also pro-Israel.
Okay, yeah. We're going to talk broadly anti-Deutsch, I suppose, and you're going to school us on that. But before we leave, you should become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada to listen to the second half of this. An important event announcement as well. The Independent Labor Club of New York has been meeting. We've got a nice core group that we met with the other day. And we're going to have another public meeting, a general meeting, this coming Friday. So 2 days, Saturday. 3 days after this episode comes out. That is Saturday at Woodbine Space at 5 p.m. Everyone's invited. We'll put a link to the address and the event in the show notes. So if you're in the New York area, we hope to see you there. And yeah, we'll see you on the other side. Okay, all right, here we are, we're on the other side. Mr. Botticelli, you're an absolute moron, you're a disgrace, and you make me sick, you moron, you miserable piece of shit. we've had a wild ride with Finkelstein over the last year, you and me.
He refused to debate us because he thought we were Marxist-Leninists. He refused to debate us. I just don't think he likes the name of the show.
No, I think
he doesn't like